Welcome to Regulatory Ramblings. Our guest today is Sinyi Ko, Director of Compliance and Regulatory Consulting at Integrity Consulting in Singapore. As an admitted solicitor and advocate in Singapore, Hong Kong, England, and Wales, as well as a licensed attorney in the U.S. state of New York, she's practiced law and also done multiple consulting stints in the field of compliance at Kroll and Duff & Phelps, as well as having been a regulator, having spent time as a deputy director at the Monetary Authority of Singapore. She has both the depth and breadth of professional experience to chat with us about today's topic. With digital finance growing, so too has the use of digital identity verification, but it's not a panacea. With some governments moving in the direction of a national digital identity, retail customer scams are also increasing. In Singapore, there have been a few policy responses, including changing money laundering laws to make it easier to prosecute those that sell their national digital identity credentials. A key policy challenge is deciding who should bear the loss in digital scams: financial institutions, customers, or other parties, especially if none were at fault. In Singapore, you have the amendments to the Corruption, Drug Trafficking, and Other Serious Crimes Confiscation of Benefits Act and the Computer Misuse Act, as well as measures to create information sharing databases for suspicious transaction reports. Over in Hong Kong, recently a case was reported where the Hong Kong police had broken up a syndicate using artificial intelligence face swapping techniques to trick banks and financial institutions into lending the money. Six people were arrested, and the local press reported that it was the first such bust using such technology. At present, creating an account with or borrowing funds in Hong Kong from a financial institution can be done online, with applicants being asked to use to scan, upload their Hong Kong identity cards, and take real-time selfies so facial recognition can verify their identities. The police in this case received intelligence that fraudsters used lost ID cards of others to fake their identities using AI face swapping technology. They took pictures and created a set of false information to borrow money online. Following their investigations, the police made arrests and busted the group. The fraudsters had used the face swapping technique at least 20 times to impersonate residents who had lost their ID cards, hoping to track the facial recognition system and complete the online procedures. At least one successful attempt was made between September last year and July this year, and the group embezzled at least eight Hong Kong ID cards and tried to take out loans from banks and loan companies, filling out 90 applications and making 54 attempts to set up bank accounts. Ultimately, only four loan applications worth $200,000 were approved. The lost ID cards were also used to register 30 prepaid SIM cards that were used to send out 7,200 phishing messages to lure residents to hand out their personal information using points as rewards for bait. At least one person's credit card was found to have been embezzled for shopping. And with that, I turn to our guest, Sinyi. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, AJ.
So before we dive into the heart of today's topic, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, your upbringing, you know, how you made it to where you are right now.
I grew up in Singapore, which is a pretty small place, and a very middle class upbringing. Happy, stable parents are civil servants. So I think I would say, yeah, I had a pretty idyllic and stable upbringing. And I thought the world was a happy place. And I was a happy child. Academically quite good. And I think it did got pretty good grades, did law, and thought that I would just probably live in Singapore for the rest of my life, right? Like Singaporean nationality, address Singapore, next destination Singapore, my boarding cards. But at some point in time, funnily enough, there was a broken heart involved, and I tried to get out of that. And I thought, oh, I'll just distract myself by going to work somewhere, right? It's not Thailand, it was Hong Kong. Got a job in Hong Kong, went to Hong Kong, worked there for 2 years, got sent by the law firm I was with to our London office, worked there for 2 years, and then eventually came back to Singapore and joined the MES when I came back and got into compliance consulting. That's been a nutshell what I did.
Okay. And the transition from law into compliance consulting was, I mean, it's pretty seamless. It's a natural one many people make, though I guess there's more of the commercial aspect once you go into consulting, which maybe some lawyers don't fully appreciate, but I don't know. Lawyers need to sell themselves too, right? I mean,
Absolutely, absolutely. So, in my interview as for the compliance consulting role, the HR director said, "You know, you're really good at being a consultant." And I was like, "Why?" I mean, legal consulting is the same as any sort of consulting. You have HR consulting, you have IT consulting, you have CRM consulting, management strategy consulting. It's all the same. People come to you, they ask you a set of questions because they need your expertise in that area. So you're either an accounting consultant, i.e., I don't know, an auditor, or you are a lawyer, or you happen to be advising on MAS regulations and you call yourself a compliance consultant. The skill sets and the delivery and the profit-making objective or helping people, whatever, it's actually the same.
Okay. And I mean, things have changed certainly since I started covering the regulatory compliance beat, but law and compliance seem to still be heavily male-dominated professions. Law seems to be changing perhaps more so than compliance, but I mean, was it ever something that, you know, intrigued you, made you pay attention? I mean, is there anything that can be done to make them more balanced, or is it a matter of, you know, water finds its own level and the people that are drawn to a particular profession are drawn to it, and whatever the you know, the gender demographic breakdown is, it is what it is.
I think it's a bit of the latter. The gender demographics lie where they are, as a product of dynamics and how people will aspire in life. So, going back to your point about law and compliance are male dominated, I actually think compliance is not male dominated. So it's interesting that you perceive it to be. Looking back at previous interviews you've done, some of your compliance subjects are actually women, right? So a lot of them are women. So would like to hear your views on that. But in law, definitely, I think that was one of the reasons why I transitioned away from being a lawyer. And having had friends with who were in audit and in medicine, maybe even in journalism, you think actually at entry level, it's pretty equal, maybe a slight bias in
Yeah,
favor
at
of
entry
women.
level. Yeah, at entry
And
level.
then you progress up the work ladder and you scour the landscape, and it's actually fewer women as you go up the chain, right? So certainly the same and in the professional services consultancy I was with. Same with the listed company directors, right? So people talk about this. What about why are there fewer women? For me, it was the realization that while law was an exciting profession, I had opportunities to travel, and everywhere I saw, we were billing in 6-minute intervals. And at night, when we were in the office with the partners, pulling an all-nighter, you'd have his wife call them multiple times and say, you know, your kids are sick. And he's like, yeah, deal with it, deal with it. And that was not eventually where I wanted to be. If our KPIs for making partner were how much 1800 chargeable hours we brought in revenue to the firm, I'm not
Right.
gonna outbeat my male counterparts because I'm putting in 1900 chargeable hours, right? That was just not what I wanted. So I sort of wanted something else that was interesting, that allowed me to do good work, be intellectual. But it also allowed me to do other things that were important in my life. And eventually, I chose to leave law to do the MAS gig. And from MAS, then you became a compliance consultant, which I think actually has a lot more work-life balance. So, hence the probably the more there are more women in the compliance consulting business in consulting in-house because of the fact that it's not so sort of time sensitive, and you're sort of able to manage your deadlines and stuff. So yeah, I mean that was the reason. And What can we do to improve the gender balance? I think work from home is a very important transformation that we are seeing filtering through the system, and I think it will it, whether it correlates to a more balanced demographic in at least in the senior levels, we will wait to see it the next 5 years. But I think it does really help because you can work around the children and all the other things you need to do, you know. What I do not want to see, and I think it's very unhealthy, and sometimes even in the women's groups, I see this, is this battle cry for affirmative action. Perversely, I think it trivializes women. What I think will happen is, like cream, the women that rise to the top will get there because their personal circumstances, their personal choices equip them to be that way. And you just have to let it be. And the women that don't actually do rise to the top, maybe they are happy in other things. They're not better or worse. It is a different path, right? So I think, you know, gender bias sees aside. Yeah, maybe men are more capable of like delegating their mid back office to their wives or spouses or something. And that is what the way it is. So yeah, I don't have an answer for it. I think you just let the market forces play out.
And indeed, that many firms in this town have come to the conclusion that the many returning mothers into the workplace, they're offering salaried only roles, and that way you don't have the, and they're reasonably well recompensed positions, but you don't have the perennial dread of the billable hour, which is the bane of the existence of many lawyers, certainly in the early part of their careers, from having any kind of work-life balance. And you know, many of them have been pretty receptive. But I'm particularly interested in your time as a regulator. And as you look back on that time, your time at the MAS and your colleagues who are, you know, the MAS are regarded as the top, the cream of the top of the, you know, the best of the best in terms of regulatory talent in Asia. What are your reflections on that time? What are you most proud of? What do you feel were your greatest achievements in that role?
Okay, well, first, let me address the MAS as an organization. It's unusual in financial services regulators in the countries I've worked in, right? So England and Hong Kong. Because everywhere else I look, Australia, US, there are many different financial services regulators that regulate the particular sliver of the sector, the industry that they are in charge of. So you typically have one for insurance, one for the banks, one for the securities industry, sometimes for payments and this and that. And then there's a central bank. In Singapore, the philosophy behind creating the MAS back in the day was that we do not have enough headcount in Singapore to support multiple organizations regulating different slivers of the sector. So we combined the central bank together with like the trade promotion body for financial services, together with the consumer protection, with the regulator for the banks in this insurance and capital markets, and now we've tagged on payments being the next addition to the financial services fray. So we have everything rolled up into one. It looks at monetary supply and exchange rates and housing and loans and bad debts and capital markets, regulates the SGX and all the other exchanges, and does a lot of stuff. So being in that organization was really interesting because I remember when I left the MAS, everybody expected me to know everything from FX trading to interest rates to, oh, I have a complaint against this bank. Can I, you know, I don't know how am I going to raise it to the governor of the MAS and stuff. So it gives you, it's an organization that has incredible breadth. And it kind of works really well because every department is sort of, yeah, it's a bit siloed. There's information barriers so that, you know, organizations and individuals' data are protected on a need-to basis. But when you've got like great financial crisis, the departments could really talk to each other without sort of like the MA talking to the securities regulator across, or I don't know, governmental lines. So that's the MAS. Then coming to how what I my personal reflections on my life in the MAS, it was very fulfilling for the soul, having come in from legal practice in England. I was happy to be back home in Singapore, and I felt like I was doing national service. So I was taking a one-third pay cut, but I was really helping the man in the street, my aunties, my mum, my dad, like sort of building a safer financial services world and making my country better. So I really enjoyed that aspect of it. And then what else? Oh yeah, you sort of have this great breadth of experience. So you see, the regulator has a very interesting role, right? The private sector doesn't do that. The private sector does whatever the private sector does, and then the policy makers, the regulators sit on top of everybody, and they have this helicopter view of where the private sector is going, and they're able to talk to other policy units like the Ministry of Finance, the tax authority, the government, and everything else. So it's got this helicopter breadth of view, and you see that interplay between policy making and working with the financial industry and with retail protection and everything. So we've got that perspective, and we also got a lot of opportunities to rotate through the different departments. Like if you wanted to go to banking, or if you wanted to do a development role, if you wanted to do exchange rates, we had it all. You just had to put up your hand and ask for a rotation. There were a lot of organizational development programs. Of course, there are also in places like the big banks or in consulting firms, but I think that those are very targeted towards, oh, you need to know this skill set because you're going up to the next grade. So it's for the organization's good that you know that. But whereas I think in the MAS, they really sent us for training because they really wanted to improve us, because as we became middle management, if you were a bad manager, it would have a profound impact on the people around you, which could not really be measured. So I mean, we had communication courses. We had, I think, 1 year they sent us to Pulau Ubin to build team relationships with our peers, and I had to lead a team that kayaked around Pulau Ubin and expose
Oh,
how bad
wow.
my topographical skills were. And I think half of the people in my little kayak group wanted to quit, right? Because they were like, my God, we did not sign up to join the MAS to kayak in hot sun under an incompetent topographic leader around Pulau Ubin, and our arms were dropping off. So yeah, it's things like that, like clear without air con, no hot water. They sent us on things like that. So we had great opportunities to learn stuff that we would otherwise not have learned.
Yeah, it sounds like they were being roasted. Literal trial by fire, given how sweltering it can get there. But yeah, some of those team building exercises are quite they really take people out of their comfort zones. But I guess that's the idea. So that was your time at the MAS, and now, I mean, the world has changed, I think, quite a bit over the course of the past decade, with fintech and crypto reaching a new level of prominence. And increasingly, we're talking about digital ID fraud. And it's turned from the Hong Kong case, it's turning out that fraudsters are ever tech savvy, and that AI biometrics, facial recognition, biometrics that were intended to safeguard the system, in terms of KYC and onboarding, that people have found workarounds, and that so these systems are compromised, and if that's the nature of the threat, then really what can be done? Because I can see many people turning cynical and saying, see, that's why we need to go to the bank in person and deal with people face to face and stick to cash. And tech and finance should not mix, or at the very least, the extent to which people want to use tech is, for their ATM or their credit cards, and maybe even that's too much. What are your thoughts on the current state of digital identity fraud and the solutions?
Sure. So one, there are things which are playing out and uncontrollable, which is the rise of everything digital. But specifically in finance, there's a rise in digital finance, right? In many forms. I was fascinated to learn about this catchphrase, embedded finance. I looked it up. It means, say we're Sephora, we sell a lot of cosmetics. Then we decide that, hey, we know a lot about our consumers, when the payday is, when they suddenly buy lots of mascara. Can we go introduce them to some payday loans or financing or buy now, pay later kind of things? Same with Walmart, Park and Shop, whatever. So they start offering financial services, right? So everybody is bubbling up and offering financial services. Everything is tech enabled nowadays. And it's all great, right? But you've got a triangle of like security, then you've got cost, and you've got ease of use, right? So to your point about, well, if it's not secure, then aren't we do we not have to go back to a bricks and mortar world? We can't, because there's such an outcry on for the competing needs of cost savings and usability, right? Ease of use, that we really have to walk a very tightrope within these three apexes of the triangle. So I don't think policymakers, even though they recognize that there are threats, they can really reverse this. The world is on a path, right? So it is what it is. And what about the state of national identity use and fraud in Singapore? So the interesting thing in Singapore is, because we're so small and the government is quite on the bandwagon in terms of connecting us on a digital infrastructure, right? Making us competitive and a good place to do business and everything. So the use of the Singapore national identity, which is called SingPass, is I think one of the highest if in the world, right? So the stats are something like we've got a user base of more than 4.2 million users and access to over 1,700 services, more than 460 government and private sector organizations. SingPass facilitates about 300 million personal and corporate transactions every year, and serves approximately 97% of Singapore citizens and permanent residents aged 15 and up. So that's a huge digital penetration, right? So we have really, compared to places like Hong Kong and Australia, I think we've made that shift really quickly. And thanks to MAS, right? So they've done a lot of great work in standardizing the QR codes so that different payment services providers can go to the retail merchants and say, just put this one code and you can use whatever app you want to pay by, and you scan one QR code instead of having a whole shop front full of different QR codes, right? So and even in the hawker centers and I think taxis and stuff, you can pay digitally through your mobile device by scanning or transferring to a phone number or something. So there are lots of the use of digital payments and digital banking, digital everything is digital insurance is enabled and encouraged, and it's usually facilitated through the use of the national identity facility that we have, right? So, which is also available to non-Singaporeans, so who are permanent residents or employment holders or something. Yeah. So we with the rise of digital financial services, as you say, it is catching the eye of fraudsters and scammers. They make it their whole livelihoods to crack the system, right? So they're looking at where the vulnerabilities are, where the newer trends are, and they are one step ahead of the public sector, as is usually the case. So,
Using the very technologies, I might add, that people said would ensure safety in fintech.
that is true. That is true. One thing we have seen a lot in Singapore is the vulnerabilities around the SMS OTP. So you have to have, well, nowadays you have to have a user ID, you have to have a password. But everybody's user IDs and passwords have been leaked in some shape or form, right? Not just in the country where they reside, but because of the use of Facebook or some sort of web application, right? So you routinely get, even Cafe or something, you routinely get emails saying, "I'm sorry, we've leaked this and that, and you just change your password." But what it means is that your first layer of defense, user ID and password, is out there in the open, right? Together with things like phone numbers and addresses, age, blah blah, social media preferences. It's all out there. And then we think, no, we just need an OTP, right? 2FA, two-factor authentication. Then we put SMS there. And now you realize that SMSs can be hijacked in many shapes or forms, right? You can call up a different telco and say, "I want to port the number." They port the number. Do not
Clone,
even tell them.
exactly. Clone SIM cards.
Right, clone SIM cards, or even I think the more egregious ones I've heard is they compromise a telco. These hackers compromise a telco somewhere else in the world, not in Singapore. And yet, the compromise of the overseas telco can lead to a diversion of the SMSs to a Singapore mobile device through no fault of the Singapore telcos, right? And through no fault of the customer. It's really bizarre. So with that sort of sophistication and speed of workarounds by the scammers, what can we do? Yeah, it's a very interesting question, which I've been recently reading up a lot about.
Things like AI and biometrics are not a panacea. I mean, but for the longest time they were being touted as you don't have to fear online transactions, you don't have to fear banking online because these will keep you safe. Now we're finding out that's not the case, in much the same way that it's been said that the NSA level algorithm that's behind Bitcoin, there are people in the know that'll tell you even that's not a complete safeguard, that it can be breached by those that know what they're doing. So with that in mind, is there some degree just of assumption of risk that we're on the path of digital banking, no turning back, past the point of no return, the figure you cited of serving 97% in Singapore. I mean, that says to me then that the powers that be in Singapore have made a collect a conscious collective decision for that society that this is the direction we're going in. That's our policy. And so I guess everyone has to, get in step. But obviously, if we're compelled to use these technologies to conduct our transactions, there does seem to be some degree of assumption of risk that at some point you will undergo some level of online mischief or chicanery or fraud. And we can only hope that the authorities and the institutions are have enough safeguards or savvy enough to notify you in time and protect you.
If the question is then, what can we do, right? This is where the Singapore policy responses have been very interesting. As you said, it seems like in Singapore there is a very clear policy shift to encouraging, actually shepherding our inhabitants towards usage of online services, especially in finance. Not just in banking, like credit card and all sorts of payments and stuff. So, because of that, there is that assumption of responsibility to then make safe that system, right? Having touted it as a viable means. So, what we are seeing is it's a very integrated approach, and I think it's also one that speaks to the makeup in Singapore, where this sort of response needs the coordination of the MAS, Monetary Authority, as the financial services regulator. You need the police, Ministry of Home Affairs. You need the regulator of the telcos. I think it's the Media Development Authority. And then in Singapore, we have a national initiative under the Prime Minister's office that is in charge of the Smart Nation Digital Initiative, right? That sort of comes up with government technologies and the national identity app and stuff. So there are a multi sectoral approach, and they're looking at, okay, this problem of the fraudsters going us one up on us, what can be done? And there are so many different things, right? So at the police level, it's always about enforcement and catching the bad guys and this and that. And then there's a lot of education to the public about malware and changing your passwords frequently and not falling prey to scams and this and that. So that's the police. Then you've got the MAS, who is encouraging the banks and the credit card and the issuers, right, your Visas, your MasterCards and everything, to have real-time fraud surveillance, monitor systems, data analytics. And also after the last, any last sort of widespread scam, then the MAS is quite quick to work with the Association of Banks in Singapore to come up with a whole series of measures that have to be implemented in a really quick time. Unfortunately, the banks have that scale and operations to support the changes, right? So it's things like having to notify the customer's old number before, or email address before you switch it to a new one, right? Because you know if your fraudsters tell you to change to a new set of contact details, you want to make sure that the old set of contact details are informed. During that period of change, within a certain time, no high risk, high value transactions can be performed. You've got to default the transaction limits for all sorts of transactions to very small amounts, maybe like $100. You've got to notify your customers the moment there are transactions made beyond a certain threshold. So all this to try and create more controls, yet not to stymie the usability, right? And the ease of use of all your digital financial services. So different successive measures have been introduced, I think it was last year. So first half of the year, we saw one set of measures being introduced. Second half of the year, we saw another set of measures being introduced by to the bank through the banks. And each successive set is sort of like the playbook for what went wrong and what we need to quickly adjust to. And that is one way for the financial services sector to help. The police also have an app called Scam Shield that they encourage Singapore inhabitants to download, and it prevents those fake phone calls or your fake friends from befriending you on social media or something like that. So there's so many different things that are being done. And you also mentioned that there is a equitable loss sharing mechanism being drawn up. The funny thing about that is that it's taking a very long time. So the set of scams we're dealing with occurred most recently in a widespread manner, 2021 end. And in February 2022, the MAS announced that it was looking into a framework for equitable loss sharing for online scams in a widespread manner that occurred through nobody's fault, right? Not the financial institution, not the telco, not the customer, and then nobody. I mean, it's some sort of fraudster. So how do we attribute the loss within the community when nobody was at fault? And as a reflection of how difficult it is to tread on such delicate matters, from February 2022 until now, we still have not seen that framework that the MAS has been working on consulting, right? So the consultation latest date is expected to be Q3, which is anytime now. And we'll watch this space as to whether or not it comes up in Q3, but certainly super challenging.
I was speaking to a lawyer in Hong Kong about the Singapore framework and then and about why it hasn't come out yet. And he said, yeah, because fundamentally it's a question of whose ox is going to be gored. He said that no policy is ever implemented on the level that someone won't be hurt, someone won't be made to pay a price. I guess the best that governments can do, I guess, is perhaps adopt a utilitarian approach of the greatest good for the greatest number. But yeah, he said, that there will inevitably be losers in this, and You might see consumers get a shorter notice period by when they have to like respond, and by when they're supposed to, like if you don't file a complaint or file a report within a certain period of time, you are assumed to have been, been put on notice or something like that.
Right. Yeah, it does require coordination of consumers to respond very quickly. That is true. And to your point about the greatest good and the greatest number, the interesting thing is so far at the occurrence of the few widespread online scams in Singapore, the loss has so far been borne by the banks. But how much can the banks bear, right? Yes, it's easier to say that the retail consumers are less able to bear it, but for the long run, we cannot keep kicking that can down the road. So this the response is pretty urgent. So yeah, I think yeah, it very well be the case that what you heard was one of the facets of that framework. But right now, consumers are certainly still pretty much in the dark as to the wider forces that are playing out and trying to make sense of it, right? Because it's quite abstract stuff. Like nobody is a security expert, nobody's a technology expert, nobody's a telco expert. We're barely trying to come to terms with digital financial services and how to use our mobile devices, and yet these are already happening. So to then add on and say, if you don't call us back within 12 hours, 24 hours, then you bear the loss, you know, whether it's 20,000, 50,000, 100,000, that I think will result in a widespread outcry. So that will not fly at this point in time.
So, again, coming back to the topic of digital identity fraud, this is a technological matter, but it has legal and financial consequences. So, with that in mind, what will be the role of lawyers in developing solutions for the problem at hand?
Right. I'm not sure that there's an immediate response for the lawyers, but
Other than helping governments draft, the requisite rules and regs.
for sure. And one other aspect of countering the scammers is the changes in legislation. You mentioned at the start of the recording that there are two acts that are being amended. And the first one is the Money Laundering Act, a very long name, but we'll call it CDSA in short, Confiscation, Drug Trafficking, and Serious Offences Act. And the other one is the Computer Misuse Act, because the frauds are enabled by the compromise of the national identity facility, right? SingPass. And what the scammers are doing is that they realize that the SingPass is the holy grail. Yes, they've got user IDs and passwords that have been leaked. They have date of births and everything. But with the national identity function, that this is the secure layer that is like the fail-safe, right? The fail-safe function. So what the scammers have done is they've gone to the man in the street and offered to buy the SingPass identity. And or the banking account usage, the OTPs, and for a fee, say for $500, you've got young people, elderly people, anything from 15 to 79, being unwitting or knowing accomplices to the scammers. And the most passive level of culpability is just selling the details and then not really knowing. Or occasionally you see some weird stuff in your accounts you're aware of, you just gotta let it go. Then the next standard of slightly higher culpability is if you are asked, hey, AJ, you don't mind, you just make those transactions once in a while. Okay, when I tell you to make those transactions, you go make the transaction. So you have another layer of like activity. And so those what we call these two groups of unwitting or knowing accomplices are the money mules. So there are these local people who sell their national identity, who sell their accounts, and then who facilitate the transactions, right? The money mules. So in order to prosecute them more successfully for money laundering or for misuse of their computer credentials, electronic credentials, we've got to change the law. We're going to introduce rash and negligent money laundering. We're also going to introduce offenses of sale of your national identity or trafficking by groups of sold national identity details. So yeah, these changes in the law will target the money mule typologies and make it a more deterrent for locals to do this, right? For whatever benefit they have, like lucky draw, like participate in this lucky draw, get some money or something, and hopefully prevent the rest of the public from being scammed.
Very much so, and they've got it down to a science now. They know, okay, what they found is when you deviate from a pattern, that's when people tend to get caught. But they also know that they need to make certain deposits a certain number of times so that those accounts don't go dormant. They again, they've got their own way of keeping track of things, their own alert system. And it does seem to me from the past cases that we've seen that when it takes ages to get multi-billion dollar, to nab people in multi-billion dollar cases. Well, in that light, the person who's making 60K a month and depositing another, sliding another 20 on the side, that type of laundering is going to slip through the nets. Inevitably, because it—I mean, the what one former HKMA staffer said to me was that no government official will say this, but the JFIU, the Financial Intelligence Unit, they're understaffed, they're overworked. That it's like aiming a fire hose at a teacup. There's only so much a person can keep tabs of.
In Singapore, to counter that, the MAS has greatly, or the authorities are greatly exhorting the use of data analytics. So how it would work in is, of course, the financial institutions that can afford it, like the banks, have every incentive to exploit artificial intelligence and data analytics to scour through the alert system and look for links and unusual activities, right? And there's a lot of reg tech tools that have popped up to service that demand or that appetite. And then outside of the financial services, the private sector, the government is using AI and data science to apply that to the hose to make sure that it is manageable for the teacup, in the sense that they're applying AI to the suspicious transaction reports, the hundreds and thousands that are filed on a daily, yearly basis, right? There are too many of them. But through network cluster analysis, you can isolate to clumps of STRs that are forming around specific FIs and around specific customer accounts. And you're going, wow, okay, this looks like it's a very busy account. What's going on there? And then you look at that. If you are a law enforcement agency, you might start investigating that as a higher priority for potential higher risk like criminal offenses, right? So in terms of active response, you investigate those potential big baddies first. And then in a supervisory basis, after the law enforcement has stepped aside and started to arrest or do things, on a supervision basis, the monetary authority will then come in and look at other institutions or entities that are linked to that clumpy, possibly dodgy client account and saying, hey, so and so FI has filed an STR. The rest of the FIs are also associated with this client, this clump, but none of them are filing. Well, you see a lot of fund flows with the other financial entities, but you do not see the other financial institutions filing STRs on the same client. Why is that? Is it because the other financial institutions do not have capable or robust anti-money laundering systems and are therefore not filing or not recognizing that their customers are dodgy? So then it makes for a better like positioning of the supervisory engagements with other FIs, right, around the SDR network analysis.
To pick up on your point about data analytics, because increasingly with the, when people have started hearing about generative AI more so in recent times, that there's a sense that low collar, low skill white collar workers may be imperiled. And what does that mean? That means that maybe some junior AML analyst, MLROs, may see their jobs get the axe, because the claim amongst some, the contention is, you're going to see greater automation of AML and KYC and FCC compliance, financial crime compliance, and that over time, you're going to see data scientists take the helm of such teams. We've had guests on the show that have offered an alternate viewpoint. But then you're going to see your AML financial crime teams run led by data scientists, because over time, it's going to be about discern going through vast troves of data and picking out tracks, discerning patterns. Does that then therefore mean that the AML profession is imperiled, or that the AML professional of the future will be not only law and reg compliant and conversant, but they'll also be techies, they'll also be tech savvy to a great extent? What are your thoughts?
If there is greater technology use, there will need to be more techies to manage the infrastructure. But in the AML framework, it is really about people, policy, and infrastructure, right? So increasingly, infrastructure is replaced by technology. So however it is, you still need people and policies to implement or to bolster the technology infrastructure piece, right? So nothing is totally technology without human involvement. And anyway, the technology I think is mainly what we're talking about is in the monitoring aspect. But let's not ignore the fact that AML is a whole scheme of things, from governance, board oversight into your three lines of defense and the customer due diligence process, right? Screening and life verification and escalation to of higher risk customers in terms of onboarding or renewal of relationships. And there's so many judgment heavy things like, oh, is that source of wealth, source of funds, does it satisfy the regulatory expectation? Those are such high level abstract things which cannot be coded, right? Because I don't know, AJ might want to prove his source of wealth in some sort of way that is very different from Sydney. So your technology will probably not be able to keep up with that variation. In any shape or form, you still need human beings, right, to complement the technology.
Very much so. And the financial crime veterans would say, do the techies know how to run investigations? Well, they know how to do the technology, and they know if you give them the right data, which they can plug in, from that they can, draw certain inferences, certain they can conjecture, they can extrapolate. But that's not the same as running an investigation, is it?
No. And increasingly, the technology in investigations is to throw up alerts of red flags, right? And then there are human beings that have to be on top of all the red flags. And in fact, managing the red flags is then another tool for technology to take over. So there, you definitely still, in forensics investigations, you still need human beings to then scour through what the technology is telling you to make sure that it works, right? So same as Ch ChatGPT is not going to properly 100% do everything, you still need a human being to massage the ChatGPT detail to make sure that's kind of looks good, right? But ChatGPT will do a lot of the groundwork. That's how it is.
Given that we are affiliated with HKU, I would like to ask, is there any advice you would give to young people in the law school or in our business school or in other programs wanting to at some point enter compliance profession and maybe even someday envisage themselves as a compliance consultant. Any tips, suggestions, guidance you could offer?
First, I think a career in compliance is very much a career where people want to adhere to the rules or are interested in understanding the rules and at least trying to comply with them in, to a reasonable extent. And contrasted with a different natural appetite for risk, right? So I think people who are compliance oriented are probably less risk of seeking, more risk averse. And then you have, in contrast, like the traders, right? The bankers who are probably a bit more risk savvy, risk seeking, and then they will really not like the compliance role, right? So I think firstly we need to dichotomize between a natural aptitude for the compliance profession, because people are, you just, they'll probably excel if there's something that kind of appeals to them in terms of character. So people who want to join the compliance profession should be already sort of like au fait with trying to follow the rules, trying to know what the rules are, and trying to work around the rules. Do not come into it if you want to make a lot of money and you don't want to comply with the rules and you feel like rules are very unnecessary. So that's just, compliance will be terrible. So that's one. And number two, what is the path to take to be a good compliance person? There is no path. I think if we do transferable fields like law and accounting, it could be useful because law and accounting are inherently very rule-based, so it will help to guide us to read up on what the rules are and like templatize what the rules are and then try and analyze and apply the rule to the facts, right? So that it leads it to a natural affinity. But if we're not in law or accounting, do not fret. I've got friends who've joined risk, who've joined operations, and then they still come up with a pretty good appreciation and respect for why rules are there and then try and reverse engineer to what they need to do. So there are quite a lot of lateral fields that make people have built up a skill set or outlook that is conducive to a career in compliance. So I think if people do what they're genuinely interested in doing, they have an inquisitive mind, they want to learn, they've sort of a good ethic, but work-life balance, the compliance profession is not a very high bar to enter, I don't think.
Interesting, because I've known many people that wanted to get into compliance, and the barrier always seemed to be they didn't have the financial services background. I mean, to me, it seems more like it's more about do aptitude plus temperament. And again, going back to what you were saying about, how people need to sometimes adjust their way of thinking for a profession that's so rule laden, but doesn't necessarily require a legal background, because many people from non-legal backgrounds have done swimmingly well in compliance. You may see it as your dream job, it seems to me, but certain personality types, certain individuals will need to adapt if they want to go down that route. But something we can definitely pick up the next time we have you on. Cindy Ko, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, AJ.
And to our viewers, thank you for joining us. Until next time.